Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Trump's Ukraine initiative, is it real and what is next? Is the U.S.-Europe rift for real or is it merely kabuki theater? Asked differently, are these serious policies or Trump's personal preferences? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we have Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Mark here in Moscow. We're beginning to get some of the outlines of what the so-called Trump-Ukraine peace initiative is. It was very controversial what Pete Hegseth said on his European trip about basically NATO membership is off the table for Ukraine. The U.S. will not commit troops. Any European troops under the flag of NATO will not have Article 5 protection. And now we're going through this absolutely absurd, ridiculous rare earths minerals dance, which is absurd on its face. Personally, I think they're talking about that so people don't ask about NATO membership. I think it's a pure diversion. Where are we on this, Mark? Because I have to say, Trump's team doesn't seem to be 100% on board. Mark?
Yeah, obviously there's some dissension within the administration, which is fairly predictable. It's I think the only unpredictable thing is that they're able to Trump and the people who want to de-escalate the U.S. from the conflict in Ukraine still seem to be pushing forward successfully, even if there is dissension from Kellogg, Waltz, and a few others within the administration. It's happening behind closed doors for the most point. I think that the Europeans, of course, and plenty of people within the U.S. and the entirety of the Western mainstream media are on the attack against Trump. The accusation is that all of this that Hegseth said are concessions being given to Russia before negotiations even begin, a betrayal of Ukraine, etc. But, I mean, Peter Hegseth had the perfect comeback. He said, this isn't concessions. This is reality. I.e., you are not living in reality. We are living in reality. And what he's not saying, but is almost, you know, completely implied, is that the war is lost. They mean you, because, of course, the Trump administration wasn't themselves directly involved in it. But the West has lost this conflict, and it's time to own up and recognize that. The Europeans aren't ready to recognize that yet. But I think the other important thing that Hegseth said has said since is he acknowledged that Russia has superiority in terms of manpower and firepower, significant advantage on the battlefield, and that no Western aid packages, no future Western aid packages will be able to change that calculus. And that is almost an important, a realist recognition of the reality on the battlefield that no other Western leader, you know, exceptions Orbán and Fitzo, have owned up to.
You know, George, the other penny hasn't really dropped, because the criticism of Hegseth and obviously the Trump administration in general is that what concessions are the Russians making? Now, taking on board what Mark just said, and I agree with him completely, but what I think this is all about, unfortunately for the Ukrainian people, not its elites, it's never really been about them. What Trump is going to say now is that we've made it very clear about NATO expansion, American troops, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Russia, you have to parlay with us on China, on Iran, and in North Korea. That's the next shoe to drop here. It's obvious to me, George.
I think that's right, because really the question is, why has there been this reversal of a U.S. policy? Now, in a sense, it isn't wholly a reversal on Trump's part. It is consistent with his themes in 2015, 2016. He said then, I don't see why there should be a conflict with Russia. Russia could be our partner. Instead, then really were implied that the real adversary of the United States is China. Then subsequently, he got into a whole thing with Iran, and he seems to be coming back to that, though that isn't immediately clear. So he wants Russia as a partner in that. But the problem is that he's now going to turn to Russia and said, look, we have given you everything that you desire. You know, we've given you, you know, respect, status. We're going to treat you as our geopolitical partner. But we want something in return. We want you to end this war now. In other words, you know, wherever you are now, you know, we want a ceasefire now, and we want it done. And this is where it gets problematic for Russia, because right. if it's a ceasefire now, then there's still a lot of goals that Russia has yet to accomplish. And of course, Russia has unfortunate experiences coming to agreements with the West in the past, whereby, you know, oh, everything's fine, you know, we're all friendly. And then 2, 3, 4 years later, you know, we've got another conflict. So it's a very difficult situation for Russia to be in. Clearly, there's been an enormous change in tone from Washington, which is very positive. But then Russia has to respond to that, because then if Russia doesn't respond, then Trump is going to turn around and say, Russia is the problem, the Europeans are right, Russia has been always the problem. We need to then go back to the policy of escalating against Russia.
Yeah, well, impeccable logic, because what we have so far, gentlemen, is that, you know, there's talk about Ukraine. It's in the center of the conversation or on the periphery. But the only thing that has really changed beyond the rhetoric is that the U.S. and Russia are talking. Well, that's a good thing here. But to kind of echo what George has said there, the Russians want some ironclad, on paper, signed, notarized, witnessed documents about their own security, because we don't need to waste our time going through the litany of lies and deceptions. The coup regime in 2014 was instantly recognized against all democratic norms by the West. Then we had the machinations of the OSCE just prior to the SMO. Then we had the Minsk process 1 and 2. Then we had Istanbul. Well, I am going through the litany. Mark, they want something more solid than that we've had in the past. Mark.
Yeah, Russia's going to drag this out forever, and they've already given plenty of signs. They're glad they're talking, right? They've got plenty of the deal with the U.S. on, but they've made clear, first of all, they've pointed out that they have no one in Kiev that can sign anything. So Trump team is actually seems focused on getting rid of Zelensky right now, and that's going to be problematic, and Russia can just sit back and eat popcorn while that happens. They don't want a ceasefire, and to be perfectly, I don't think they intend to stop the conflict in any way, shape, or form anytime soon. They've got their boot on the Kiev regime's throat. They're not going to pull it off. They're not going to play that Hollywood game of, I should have killed you when I had the chance this time. I think they're going to go all the way. And I think Trump has made a couple of statements in the past week that show that he actually understands the position that the U.S. is in these negotiations and on the battlefield. He said that Russia doesn't need a deal. They can take all of Ukraine if they want. He said that. He also pointed out that Russia could have bombed Kiev into the ground, could have destroyed it several times over, and has no interest in doing so. And that's also true. And he also pointed out that Russia has all the leverage, all the cards in negotiations. He pointed that out because Russia has already taken so much of Ukraine's territory. So obviously, Trump is informed enough. Between that and the statements we've got from Hegseth, the Trump administration is now aware of what a weak card they have. This statement by Kellogg's about splitting Russia, about the concessions that Russia should make, being to break their alliances with China, Iran, and North Korea, are as fantastical, as much of a fantasy land scenario as it is for the Europeans to believe that they can still win this conflict. They're both living in fantasy realities, right? The Russia understands that they can't trust the West, including Trump, any further than they can throw them. And if they did trust Trump, he's gone in 4 years. They're not thinking in U.S. election cycles. They're thinking for the long term. I think what's actually likely, the big rupture in geopolitics, the big split that's likely to occur, is not the special relationship between Russia and China or between Russia and Iran, but the special relationship between the United States and Europe.
Okay, and that's exactly what we're going to talk about in the second part of the program. I absolutely agree. George, Zelensky's name has popped up here. A lot of theater being played out here. It's quite hilarious watching peak Zelensky again on Twitter. most people there don't even have a clue what they're talking about. But, I mean, and this is also kind of a diversion because it's instead of focusing on the military realities that the West has brought Ukraine to, with Ukraine volunteering for this ridiculous, deadly exercise, and now it's a battle of personalities. This is exactly the kabuki theater that the West always plays. It's about the guy in the white hat and the guy in the black hat, which is completely divorced from geopolitics. George.
No, that's right. And it is kind of very amusing that the media are all on board. They're all singing from the same hymn sheet, which is, we can't possibly have elections, no elections, and no possibility of elections in Ukraine. Out of the question, there's a war on, no elections, no elections. But they seem to forget that there were elections in Iraq during the war. There were elections in Afghanistan during the war. Again, you may not think that they were much.
The United States had an election in 1864.
That's exactly 1864. South Vietnam, I mean, you know, people with the longer memories, South Vietnam had innumerable elections during the war years. So people didn't have any problems. But it's amazing how everyone has this, you know, everyone sinks on the same sheet. You know, there's a talking point, and then everyone repeats it. Just like this this poll that came out from some Kiev Institute that Zelensky enjoys 57% approval.
And then the media... Brought to you by USAID. Thank you, George.
Exactly. Yes, you know, 57%. What political leader anywhere enjoys a 57% approval?
Well, George, if he did have 57%, why doesn't he have elections?
Exactly. So, they're obviously coming up with all of this. But it's not going to be easy to oust Zelensky, because I don't know who exactly would replace Zelensky. And I don't know even the people who are being talked about as realistic figures would be, in a way, any better. I mean, you know, Zelensky is obviously the one who's being talked about, but I don't know whether Zelensky would be any better.
We're rapidly running out of time in this block of the program, but who does have legitimacy? That is the question here, and that is something they're going to have to grapple with. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Mark, let's go back to you here in Moscow. You already hinted in the first part of the program, getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but what special relationships are at stake right here? And I think you're absolutely right. It's the transatlantic one. I have a long enough memory that, you know, it's been tested every once in a while, and, you know, a lot of noise, you know, and not much heat is generated. Obviously, this is something of a different magnitude. But because the Europeans, the UK, have, you know, debased themselves so very much, they have very few resources to resist. Okay. The only only real weapon of resistance they have is rhetorical. It's social media. But other than that, there is not much there. And you know what, gentlemen? They're just going to fall in line because they have no other alternative. Mark.
Yeah, I think the big question, right, we've seen where the Trump chaos bomb is going off. It's going off in Washington, D.C. against the deep state, and it's going off on the transatlantic relationship, right? Atlanticism, or you could more specifically say NATO, although it's not restricted to just the institution of NATO. And Trump not only doesn't have any interest in Europe, he has contempt for Europe, for European leaders. He is obviously focusing his foreign policy vision on coming to terms, whatever those terms might be, with what he sees as the other two great powers, Russia and China. Notice that Europe, the EU, is not one of those great powers. Therefore, they don't really matter. And the Europeans have obviously, the current crop anyway, have become colonized by the idea of previously U.S. exceptionalism, now Western exceptionalism, to an even greater degree than the United States now, at least with the new administration. They believe that they are morally, structurally, and societally superior to everyone else on the planet, including the United States right now. But for Trump, it's more than, I think, a foreign policy decision, although I think that's obviously part of it. But it's also personal. Trump hates the EU liberal technocratic elite. He hates all these EU leaders that came out supporting Biden and Harris openly, Starmer sending operatives to campaign for Harris, all this talk about Trump-proofing their conflict in Ukraine. He despises them. He also despises Zelensky and the Kiev regime in general because they were instrumentally involved in the whole Russiagate hoax, an impeachment attempt against him, the Steele dossier, all of this stuff. He wants some payback. I think that Trump, much like he wrecked Obama's JCPOA with Iran, is set on wrecking the Ukraine conflict. Biden's, you could argue, signature.
Well, that's why I said in my introduction, George. I mean, at least in this regard, it's deeply, deeply personal with Trump. He is settling accounts because, as Mark pointed out, Russiagate, the first impeachment, all had everything to do with Ukraine. And the same cast of characters are there. Trump is in no mood to reward these people, okay, at all. As a matter of fact, he wants to show that he was the victim of this. It's really interesting how MAGA has adopted a victimization profile. But that's a program for an idea for a different program. But it is personal for him, George.
It is personal. And there's no question that really, you know, from his earliest days, Trump has been a NATO skeptic. However, you know, again, those of us of an older generation will remember there have been so many of these transatlantic rifts over the years, from the 1950s with John Foster Dulles agonizing reappraisal, the 1960s, all the talk about nuclear decoupling, when, you know, the Americans aren't going to sacrifice Washington for Dusseldorf. And then with the, you know, the 70s, you know, the Americans aren't paying attention to our security. And every time the Europeans have said, well, all right, well, maybe we should think about a European security and defense administration. Maybe Europeans should take more interest and concern about their security. The Americans have come down like a ton of bricks, said, how dare you talk about any kind of separation from NATO. You know, Madeleine Albright's famous 3 Ds, no decoupling, no duplication, no discrimination. And Trump himself, in 2018, when Macron started mumbling about, well, maybe the Europeans should do more, you know, that they take care of the security, he said, don't you even dare think about that. We Americans, we came to your rescue in the First World War, came to your rescue in the Second World War, you know, we won the Cold War. How dare you think about separating from us? So I don't think it's going to happen. I think Europe is very, very useful for America. It's a way that America projects its power in the world. It's how it gets to be a global power and bullies everyone around. What it wants from Europe, however, is to focus on Europe, do more in Europe so that the Americans can concentrate on China. So it's really a kind of a division of labor. And for the Europeans, they're not going to, they don't want to step up. You know, they'd have to give up their 6-week vacations, their universal health care, guaranteed incomes, that very, very comfortable lifestyle that Europeans enjoy. So they're not going to do anything, you know, to start, you know, despite all the talk, they're not going to do anything about their own security. So I think whichever way this Ukraine debacle resolves itself, I don't think there's going to be a split between America and Europe.
It's very interesting, Mark, because there was with the advent of the first Trump administration, the 2% of GDP spending on defense was the new benchmark. Now he wants to up the ante to 5%. Which is extremely unlikely and probably detrimental. But I mean, my inclination about has always been Trump's and people around him that agree with him say, if Russia is such a threat to you, then why don't you spend 5%? And then they're going to come to the realization, well, maybe they're not that big of a threat. I mean, I think he's forcing them to make that decision. I tend to agree with George. There's a lot of people that are really cheerleading the end of NATO. And I'd like to see the end of NATO, but I don't see it happening anytime soon. Mark?
I think it depends. I think everything is on the table now, right? I've had to do some serious assessment here. And a lot of it depends on what happens even personally between Trump and European leaders. If they're smart and roll over and show their bellies to Trump, right? Still won't have any respect for them, but you know, they might be able to last through the next 4 years. If they do what Zelensky has done over the past week and openly challenge and insult him back, then anything is really on the table. As I think it's more important what happens after Trump. Does J.D. Vance succeed him, then he can carry on. If not, then the U.S. can go right back to the role that they had with Europe, you know, 4 years before. So there's a lot still on the table. But I think another important thing with all of this is that all of this last 8 years of liberal attempt, both in the United States and the intelligence community and in Europe and the media, to try to use the issue of Russia. All right, Putin, Trump has always had a degree of respect for Putin, right? From the beginning as a strong leader. But they tried to paint him as a puppet of Putin, right? They tried to paint him as a traitor, as just an instrument, as an authoritarian, like they call Putin. And I think all of that has blown back in a big way. All that Russiagate attempt to slur Trump has actually pushed Trump into embracing Russia in a way that he might not have before. And so I think that in trying to delegitimize Trump with Russiagate, they have created a Trump-Putin monster of their own accord.
What do you think about that, George? Because not that I'm an avid viewer of Rachel Maddow. She's back on the Russia horse right now. I find it very odd because it didn't really garner any dividends for those people, but that they really don't have much left. I mean, they have Zelensky as their liberal hero. There are a lot of people that still walk around with masks. I mean, COVID was one of their sacred cows as well. It's not giving them dividends. Maybe you're both right. They're just going to try to outride Trump. I don't know. George?
Well, it gave them some dividends. I mean, they in 2018, they won the midterms, they impeached him, they had Mueller investigation, and that weakened Trump. I mean, there's no question the first term of Trump was a failure, and it was a failure in large part because of Russiagate. He was thrown off balance. He couldn't really get his bearings. He pursued a very anti-Russian policy, including sending lethal weaponry to Ukraine. So it did deliver something. What it didn't do, of course, it didn't destroy Trump, which is what they were hoping for. But now, you know, all these years later, I don't think it's going to achieve very much. But I think it, you know, Mark is right. Clearly, Trump is now angry and is pursuing a policy that he might not have pursued had it not been for Russiagate. We'll also see what happens generally. When Europe is under the control of the kind of center-left liberals, relations with the United States are fraught. And so even if policies may not change that much, if you get some center-right people in power in Europe, relations will improve. Now, for instance, in Germany and Chancellor Scholz, I think, is going to be replaced by Merz. And of course, Merz is even more hawkish on Russia than Scholz is. But I suspect he'll be able to get on Trump's wavelength more than Scholz has. I mean, Trump just cannot get and understand and cannot talk to people like Scholz and Starmer and Macron. But with somebody like Merz there, you know, then it'll be kind of going back to the days of Helmut Kohl. Okay, he's a Christian Democrat, he's a conservative, and there'll be some kind of communication. So it's not necessarily the question on Russia. It's just that he will have a way of communicating with him that he didn't have with Scholz and doesn't have with Macron or Starmer.
Well, to finish off, gentlemen, Trump, everything with Trump is personal, but security infrastructure is about far more important things. The European security architecture is in disrepair, it's in tatters, and I don't know if we're going to move any closer to fixing it. Fixing U.S.-Russia relations is one small step, so we'll see. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.